Moving forward into the 10th step. Halfway down the page on 84, this thought brings us to step 10. Which thought are we talking about? This thought brings us to step 10. Work. We can't pause throughout the working of the 12 steps and expect to have the results that we talked about after the 9th step. We're not going to have the 9th step promises come true in our lives if we stop working. We start working the 10th step literally after we take our 5th step. Because we do our 5th step, we do 6 and 7 and 8 in that hour or so that we take after we do our 5th step. And then we don't stop, we go out and start making our amends. And once we start making our amends, then we're doing a 10th step on a daily basis. Why do you suppose that is? Why is it that we continue immediately with the 10th step? There's no pause, there's no rest. You're continuing to clean house because you don't want your house to get dirty again. So the 10th step starts the night after you do your 5th step. You go do your 5th step, you get home, you do 6, 7, and 8, you make a list of the people you harmed, you get ready to start making amends to them, and that night you take a 10th step. And he's going to give us specific directions on how to do the 10th step. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along, meaning as we go along cleaning up the past. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. That's what we started in the 3rd step. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So what does that mean? What's understanding and effectiveness mean? In understanding how we're blocked off from a higher power. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. In understanding what God's will for us is in the world, and effectiveness in putting that into practice. Right? That's what we're talking about. So the 10th step is the tool that we use on a day-to-day basis to see what aspects of self may be blocking us off from knowing what God's will is for us and how good a job we are doing it, putting God's will to work in our lives. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. So notice it doesn't say if these crop up. It says when these crop up. And what is that list of words? Resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear. What does that sound very similar to? The same things we talked about in the 4th step. Yeah, so the 10th step is just redoing the 4th step on a smaller scale. We're looking on a day-to-day basis in our lives to see how we're doing with the character defects that we identified in the 4th step. That's what the 10th step's all about. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. So that's a direction. The very first thing we do when we see that we're being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, resentful, whatever it is, whatever the character defect is that we've identified, the very first thing we do is ask God at once to remove them. Discuss them with someone immediately. The next thing you do, so you say a little prayer about it, ask God to take away whatever the character defect is, call your sponsor or a friend in the program and say, you know what, this is what I'm doing. I just saw myself lying. I just started being dishonest with somebody. Or I'm acting selfishly. Whatever it is, whatever's coming up for you, discuss it with somebody immediately. Make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. The next set of directions. So after you have a conversation with God about it, you see that you're being selfish, dishonest, or resentful, fearful, whatever the character defect is. You talk to God about it. You call your sponsor or somebody that you're close with in the program and tell them what you're doing. Sounds just like the 5th step, doesn't it? Make amends quickly if you've harmed anyone. There's the 9th step. And then resolutely turn your thoughts to someone that we can help. Why do you suppose he gives us that direction? What's the best thing we can do to get out of self?
Work with another
alcoholic. Exactly. The best way to get out of selfishness or self-centeredness is to be of service to others. So when you see during the day at work that you're being a real jerk with the people at work, you talk to God about it. Call your sponsor and say, you know, I'm being a real jerk at work. Go to the people at work and make amends. And then go to the meeting, find a newcomer to work with, or listen in the meeting for somebody else that's suffering and try and share your experience with them. That's the prescription that the 10th step offers us. It doesn't say, sit at work all day pissed off because you don't like what other people are doing, go to the meeting and complain about it for 10 minutes, go home, call three people and complain about it to them for 10 more minutes, and then watch TV. It doesn't say that. Those aren't the directions. Okay? So it says, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. What does it take to keep in fit spiritual condition? Working the 10th, 11th, and 12th step on a daily basis. It's the program of spiritual maintenance. That's what we're doing from this point forward. Maintaining our sobriety by maintaining our spiritual condition. So we read this paragraph from the bottom of 84 to the top of 85 when we first started the book workshop. We've now gone through those 24 pages that we keep referring to that encompass the main meat of the program of recovery. And at this point, we are recovered alcoholics. The mental obsession has been removed. We're placed in a state of neutrality as far as alcohol is concerned. And as long as we do what's necessary to maintain our spiritual condition, that's the place we stay in. That doesn't mean we're never going to be tempted. Doesn't mean we're never going to want to drink again. It says, if tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We're going to want to drink. It's going to happen. We're going to get tempted. But we're going to react differently because our defense against the first drink comes from a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. We have no mental defense against the first drink. We don't sit in an AA meeting and say, today I choose not to drink. Because I don't choose not to drink. Today I choose to take actions which provide me with a spiritual defense against taking the first drink. And that's the choice that I have. The choice not to take a drink comes when I woke up this morning and I didn't want to have to pray and meditate before I left the house. But I did, because that's what I have to do to maintain my spiritual condition. Now, if I choose not to do the things to maintain my spiritual condition, then I've made the choice to drink, because it's just a matter of when that's going to happen, because I have no mental defense against the first drink. It's not coming back. So when you notice that you're off your spiritual condition, you notice that you're off the beam, what do? The same thing they told you in kindergarten when you were on fire. Stop, drop, and roll. Stop, open the big book to page 84. Read the directions. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Take out a sheet of paper, turn it sideways, draw out your four columns, and write down your resentments, your fears, and if there's any sex harms that you've done since the last time you took an inventory. Just put them all down. Just do a mini fourth step right then and there. It'll take you 15 or 20 minutes. You've got the directions. You put them in the application for the rest of your life. Call your sponsor and say, I got some stuff I got to discuss with you. I took an inventory. Have a conversation with God. Ask that you get over whatever it is you're struggling with self-centeredness. Then resolutely turn your thoughts to how you can be of service to others. Go find somebody else to do 12-step work with. That's how we keep ourselves in fit spiritual condition. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. That means it's going to happen. You'll do it for 3 days straight, and then you won't do it for 3 days straight. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Remember, we define the word will as thinking. So this is how the program works for us. We try to keep a vision of what God would have us be in the world in front of us. And we exercise our thinking along those lines all we wish. So what would God have me do today? God would have me carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to somebody else who's suffering from alcoholism. Now I'm going to spend my time thinking about ways in which I can do that. When I start off in the morning with a period of prayer and meditation, and I ask to be relieved from selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking motives, then I'm able to move forward in life and see where I can contribute and be of service rather than see how to get things to be the way I want it to be. Much has already been said about receiving strength and inspiration and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. Notice this line, if we have carefully followed directions. Bill starts the entire big book, the entire thing starts off by saying it's a precise set of directions. Later he says, we're painstaking about this phase of our development. Painstaking means that we don't leave anything to chance. We really try and be as precise as possible in what we're doing. Now he's telling us that we've carefully followed directions, meaning we've adhered as strictly as we can to the directions that are given in the book. In the foreword to the second edition, it says, to those who come to AA and really tried to put the program into application. It's the same thing that he keeps repeating over and over for us. There's a set of directions, specific program of action. We want to try and put it in application as best as we possibly can and as closely as we possibly can to what's intended for us to do. It's a specific set of directions. We want to follow it to the best of our ability. We're not going to be perfect at it, but we always want to try and follow it to the best of our ability. To some extent, we've become God conscious. We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means what? More action. So we're ending step 10 on page 85. It's actually, he's going to give us some other directions that have to do with step 10 in a moment, but we follow step 10 up by more action. Everything's followed up with more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? So what does it mean when we retire at night? Yeah, before we go to sleep. Yeah, before you fall asleep, constructively review your day. Look to see which character defects were flaring up. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? I mean, were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others? Of what we could pack into the stream of life? It's just like the third step, right? Were we thinking of ourselves, our plans, and our designs? Or were we thinking of others and how we could contribute or be of service? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for this would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what constructive measures should be taken. So that's what we do at the end of the night. It's a great idea to keep your big book next to your bed. When you go to sleep, review this paragraph and follow the directions. Makes it really easy. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. So what does he mean when he says on awakening? Okay, first thing when we wake up, before you get up out of the bed, the moment you realize you're conscious. Why does he say it this way? Why does he say on awakening? Bill Wilson knows that the first thing we do when we wake up is we start thinking about all the things that are wrong and what we have to do about them, and we get caught up in fear and resentment and bitterness right away. He knows that we start our day off that way and we're headed for trouble. So he says on awakening, and he really means that. He means, like, the moment that you realize you're awake, think about the 24 hours ahead. Consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. So what we do is we wake up in the morning. The first thing we do once we realize we're awake is we have a little conversation with God and say, please help me to be free of selfishness, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Let me see where I can be of service today. Then we think about what we have to do during the day. All right, I got to get up, got to make the coffee, got to feed the dog or the cat or whatever it is, get the kids off to school, drive to work. Oh, there's going to be rush hour traffic. You know what? As I'm going to work, please help me to have patience and tolerance and just to accept that everybody else out there in the world is trying to get somewhere also, and I'm not that special. Get to work, thinking about our day at work, who we have to deal with, who we have to interact with, who we're going to see. Make sure that there's no problem areas in advance that we're going to run into there. Then think about what we have to do after work. Think about going to that 8 o'clock AA meeting that we always go to, and that guy that always shares that we hate is going to be there. So God, when he starts sharing, please help me to be loving and tolerant. Help me to remember that you're running the show, and he may be sharing something that somebody else needs to hear. It has nothing to do with me. Whatever the situations are, we try and see them coming in advance. Say a little prayer about anything that we're not sure about how to handle, that we'd be given strength throughout the day to handle whatever comes up. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Remember, when I repeat something over again, it's because you really want to hear that. So when you're thinking about your day, don't struggle. If you start to panic, you're thinking about something you have to do, that's when you want to have a little conversation with God about it. And by doing this, we're setting ourselves up for spiritual success as we go through the day. What used to be the hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. So, don't pray for a red Corvette so you can drive other people to AA meetings with it. Right? When you're talking to God, you can ask for anything you want to ask for. You can have a conversation about anything you want to ask about. Right? It's your relationship with God. Nobody else knows it besides you. But the history of the ages has taught us that asking God for specific things can often get us to trouble. So the suggestion that AA has to give is be careful about that sort of stuff. Ask to be free of selfishness, dishonest, or self-seeking motives, and ask to see where you can contribute. Chances are you won't go wrong with that stuff. When we get into specifics, sometimes we can get into trouble. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. Bill's not telling us that we have to rejoin whatever religion we grew up in. What he's saying is that a lot of us have a religious history that's really rich, and there may be something in there that you can make use of. You know, he says to us later, he says, be quick to see where religious people are right. So if there's something in the religion of your upbringing that you can use as a tool for yourself, grab hold of it and use it. Or in some other religion that you want to follow. There's lots and lots of information out there. There's lots and lots of stuff that we can use in order to enhance our spiritual connection. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we've been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. What's that mean, be quick to see where religious people are right? So what it means is up until now, we've been quick to see where they're wrong. But there's lots of things that they do which work really well. So be quick to go out and find those. Look at the religions of the world and find things that work and put them into application for yourself. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It's a reference back to the third step. It's a lot of work playing God, isn't it? A lot of work playing God. So we're not burning up energy foolishly trying to do that anymore. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. Discipline in this sense isn't meant as a punishment. What it means is that we don't take on anything and put it into application for long in our lives. We don't use anything as a tool in our lives, transcending all aspects of life. So when we say that alcoholics are undisciplined, and we let God discipline us along these lines, it's referring to that we use prayer and meditation as tools day to day in our lives in order to overcome the aspects of self which are cutting us off in relationship with God and relationship with others. It's a practice, right? A discipline is a practice. We have to put it into application. But this is not all. Guess what? There's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Any questions about 10 and 11 before we move forward? It's not an overnight matter. It's a process that should continue for our lifetime. We've got to work at perfecting and enlarging our spiritual experience. To perfect doesn't mean to make it perfect, but to refine it. These practices of inventory taking and prayer meditation are tools we use on a day-to-day basis in order to continue to grow, to maintain our spiritual condition. The question was, do part of steps 10 and 11 overlap? Yeah, they do. In the 11th step, he's telling us about the process of inventory taking also. So there's three types of 10-step inventories that we've listed. The first is the spot check inventory. Throughout your day, you pause. Check in and see where you're at. Are we agitated? Are we doubtful? Are we acting selfishly? Is there something going wrong? During the spot check inventory, if you see anything out of whack, you go back and you do the directions that he gives us in the 10th step. Pray about it. Talk to another person. Discuss what's going on. Make amends quickly if you've harmed anyone. And then look to see what you can contribute, where you can be of service. The second inventory is the end of the day inventory, which is the thing we do at night when we retire. Before we go to sleep, we review our day constructively, looking to see if we were acting on self most of the time or how good a job we were doing at putting these principles into application. We're not taking that inventory at the end of the day to find out if we're wrong or bad. We're taking it to find out how good a job we're doing at work in the program in our life. Our next function, he told us, is to grow in understanding and effectiveness of putting God's will to work in our life. So it's essentially saying that our next function is to develop the third step and the decision we made on a regular basis in our lives. So what we're going to do is on a day-to-day basis is check in and see how good a job we're doing at that. So then the third type of 10th step inventory, which we discussed earlier, is to redo essentially a fourth step. Take a look at life. What's going on? In the 10th step and the 12 and 12, he says that many of our fellowship go out for regular, annual, or routine house cleanings. So we sit down, we write a full inventory, we look at what's going on in our lives, we check to see if we've got any resentments, any fears, or if there's any sex situations that we need to clean up. So we do that on a regular basis so that we can keep our house clean. So those are the three types or the three ways in which we work the 10th step. So moving forward into the chapter working with others, once again, there is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. So you can believe in God all day long, but if you're not carrying the message of AA or trying to be of service to others, then you're missing half the program. And chances are it's going to be hard to stay sober. Top of page 89, working with others.
Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill.
So let's emphasize that point one more time. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Nothing will ensure your sobriety like working with other alcoholics.
Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is a bright spot of our lives. Perhaps you are not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They will be only too glad to assist you. Don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You will be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim.
So they're giving you a lot of directions here because this is before AA existed in the capacity that we have it today. So they're telling you how to go out and find other drunks to work with. But you can still use this today. You may be visiting a town or living somewhere where there isn't that much Alcoholics Anonymous going on. So by following these directions, you can find other people to do 12-step work with.
When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they are dealing with a sick person.
In most cases, today when we do 12-step work, it'll be with a newcomer that we meet at an AA meeting. So how would we put this paragraph into application in that situation? You meet some person at an AA meeting and you know that they're there for the first meeting. So the paragraph tells us, find out all you can about them, right? Well, you're not going to say, give me your phone number so I can call your family and find out all I can about you. You're just going to have a brief casual conversation with the guy or the girl. If you're a lady, work with ladies. If you're a guy, work with guys. It just works better that way. Hey, I noticed you're here for your first meeting. I hadn't seen you here before. My name's Ken. How's it going? Oh, pretty good. You know, I'm just coming here because I got a DUI. Okay, so now you know the reason why he's coming. But chances are, if somebody got a DUI, there may be a problem with drinking. Really, what happened? Is that your first one? Oh, no, it's my 16th. You know, okay, well, now you know this person's probably got a problem with alcoholism, right? So you can gear your conversation around how you saw, or in your own life, you weren't able to see how your drinking was affecting your life. Because that's obviously maybe what's going on with this guy. So just have a casual conversation. Don't say, tell me everything about yourself. But just find out, in general ways, what their situation is and how they ended up coming there.
If there's any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You need this information to put yourself in his place, to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned.
Right, but once again, don't ask him for his wife's phone number or her for her husband's phone number so you can contact. Gather that information through a casual conversation with that person if they're open to talking about it. If they say to you, you know, I'm just coming here because I got a DUI, I don't think I've got any problems with alcohol, you know, or anything, I never drink, just a one-time thing, you know, then you're like, okay, well, you know, I hope you have a good time while you're here, and if you got any questions, feel free to ask. They're not interested in quitting drinking at that point. But if the person says, man, you know, I've been coming to AA a lot, it's just not working, I keep drinking, I've been doing this for 15 years or whatever it is, and it's not working, well, now you understand some of their history and you know how to approach them. You want to approach them from the place of, well, I had trouble getting sober too until I started following these directions, and then that really made a difference for me.
Sometimes it is wise to wait till he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it is better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he is very drunk, unless he is ugly and the family needs your help. Wait for the end of the spree, or at least a lucid interval. Then let his family or friend ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others, and who will be glad to talk with him if he cares to see you.
So if you've got somebody at work or somebody you know socially and they say to you, you know, I've got a friend that's got a problem with drinking, you know, and I know that you don't drink, is there something that you can do? Then you tell them, yeah, I'm a recovering alcoholic, this is what I've done, you know, this is my situation. And you say to that person, have a conversation with them next time they seem to be struggling and ask them, would they stop if they could? Would they be interested in meeting somebody who solved their problem? And if the alcoholic or the drinker comes back and says, no, I'll handle it on my own, leave it at that. Don't force yourself.
If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of his drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval. Here, no specific rule can be given. The family must decide these things, but they urge them not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters.
Skipping down to the middle of page 91.
See your man alone, if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit. But say nothing, for the moment, of how that was accomplished. If he is in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell some of his. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we have done it in the chapter on alcoholism. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady.
So why does Bill say it like that? Why does he say if you're satisfied that he's a real alcoholic? If the guy says to you, you know, yeah, I may or I may not be, and, you know, maybe I just drank a little too much and I can stop on my own, you don't want to start talking about the hopelessness of alcoholism and the fatality of the mental obsession and the physical compulsion, because he's just going to be like, well, that's not me. You'll end up in an argument more than you'll end up doing any good. So if you listen to him describe his situation and you're thinking at that point, you're like, yeah, you know, chances are this guy's got the problem, then turn the conversation to how hopeless it is. Don't talk about the program of recovery yet. Talk about the hopeless state of mind and body. Remember what Dr. Silkworth and Bill Wilson discussed about what William James said. Deflation at depth. The alcoholic has to experience deflation at depth if they're going to become willing to seek spiritual help.
Show him, from your own experience, how the queer mental conditions surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't, at this stage, refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can, if he is not too alcoholic. But insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he is alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question, if he will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it empathetic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles.
We don't launch off on the 12-step conversation with the statement of, well, you know, I used to drink just like you and I really had a problem, but now I found a relationship with a power greater than myself that solves all my problems, and I pray and meditate daily and I make amends quickly to anybody I've harmed, and then I look to see where I can be of service to others. Right? Because the alcoholic's going to shoot himself in the head if you say that. When Bill started doing 12-step work after he got sober through his contact with Ebby in the Oxford group, that's what he would do. He would go in and he would see these guys that were on the drunk ward and he would talk to them about how miserable he was. And then he would say, now I had a white light spiritual experience and I live by the 6 guiding principles of the Oxford group, being absolutely kind, absolutely loving, absolutely honest, absolutely tolerant, absolutely blah, blah, blah. And everything's great and I'm a wonderful human being. You know, and the alcoholics would just, they'd die. You know, because they'd be like, well, I can't do that. Most alcoholics don't want to do any of that. So Dr. Silkworth had a conversation with Bill Wilson before he left on his trip to Akron. Bill approached him and he said, I'm having so much failure You know, I don't know that this is working. And Dr. Silkworth explained to Bill, he said, Bill, first you tell these guys about being a drunk and they can relate to you. And then you launch off on this tirade about your spiritual experience in the Oxford group, and they shoot themselves in the head because they know they can't do any of that. Dr. Silkworth said, remember this idea of deflation at depth that William James wrote about. You've got to get the alcoholic to see the hopelessness and futility of his life, because only then will he ask the question of, what do I have to do? And only then will he be willing to say, okay, I'll do anything. You know, anybody else in the world that's got a disease, if you went to him and you said, you know, you've got this hopeless disease and you're going to suffer incomprehensible levels of demoralization and suffering, you're going to destroy everything in your life through this illness, or you could pray about it and it'll be removed. They'll pick up the prayer like that. They'll just be like, oh, wow, it's a solution. Great, wonderful. You go to an alcoholic and you say, you've ruined your life. Everything's a mess as a result of your drinking, and there's nothing you can do to stop. It's hopeless. And the worst part is, you've got years left that you're going to destroy, and you're going to be miserable the whole time, and everybody is just going to be miserable with you. Or you can seek spiritual help. The alcoholic says, I don't know. That's a lot to ask, spiritual help. Maybe being a drunk isn't that bad. We're the only ones that don't want to have to accept spiritual help for our fatal illness. Everybody else would pick it up like it was cream cheese and cherries. But we look around and we're like, is there any other way? Can I do anything other than pray and be nice to people? So when you're doing your 12-step approach, when you're talking to somebody, you really want to dwell on the hopelessness of the disease, that it's always going to get worse and never better. And you'd want to do that from your experience. Talk about how you couldn't stop drinking, no matter what you tried. And eventually they're going to say to you, well, what did you do? And then on the top of page 93, where Casey just read, it says, tell them exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual future freely. If the guy doesn't want to hear any talk about God, then he's not really willing to go to any lengths to get sober at this point, right? And so then you can let him know, you know what? You don't have to worry about anything you've heard up about God up until now. That's not the God I'm talking about. What helped Bill Wilson so much was when Ebbie said to him, Bill, try a God of your own understanding. Whatever your own conception of God is, that's all you need to make a beginning. You don't have to believe anybody else's. A higher power of your own conception, that's all you need. So you let the person know that, and if they're willing, if they're really interested in getting sober, then they'll be like, okay, maybe I can do that. And then you explain to them that there's nothing you need to make a beginning other than willingness to believe. And that through working the rest of the steps, that higher power, that conscious contact with the higher power, you'll get it. It'll happen for you. That all it takes to make a beginning is willingness. And if the person's willing, then they can move forward. But if they're not willing, just as I said to you when we started this whole study off yesterday, if they're not willing, don't bring them forward into working the steps, because it's not going to work for them. And it's just going to lead them to being disappointed.
When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are.
Okay. Don't raise such issues. Don't arouse prejudice that may already exist for this person by being dogmatic about your own spiritual beliefs. Casey is a guy that I sponsor. Casey, what's your religious belief system?
Jesus. I'm on the side of Jesus.
Yeah. Casey's Christian, yeah. Right? And very active, right?
Yes.
What's my religious belief system?
Jewish.
Does that interfere at all with us having a conversation about God and working the program?
No.
Not at all.
Right.
Why is that? Why doesn't it interfere?
Because we don't try to push our beliefs on each other.
We don't talk about that at all.
Right.
And when I 12-stepped you, did I bring up my belief system at all?
No.
I talked about God and a connection with a higher power.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
That's what works. And it's not about that there's something wrong with your religious belief system. But how would it have showed up if I would have tried to convert you to Judaism? How would that have worked?
No, not very good.
Not very good at all, right?
Right.
And if I would have started having a theological argument with you, how would that have worked?
Not well either.
Not well either. And it won't work for you with anybody you're 12-stepping. Your religious beliefs are your religious beliefs. They're dear to you. Hold them closely to your heart. But you don't have to give them to anybody else because it doesn't make a difference for them. Remember, this person is going to develop a relationship with a power greater than themselves by working steps 3 through 9, just as is available to you. That's what they're going to do to develop that relationship. And you don't know what that relationship needs to look like. It's none of your business. It's between them and God. So give them the space they need to do that in. That also means that if you're in an AA meeting and the topic of God comes up, speak in general terms. Don't hammer your belief system on other people in an AA meeting because you think it's the right thing to do and you think that they ought to believe like you. It won't work. All you'll do is turn people off. And then you're hampering your ability to be of service to God and the people around you. You're missing the point entirely when you do that. So give freely of yourself, but let other people come up with their own conceptions when you're doing 12-step work. It's very important. Very important.
Page 94, first paragraph. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you have helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions.
So, you know how we talk about AA ruins your drinking? If you're an alcoholic, you come to a few AA meetings, you're just never going to be able to drink the same again. It's a good thing. If somebody's struggling with whether they're an alcoholic or not, it's okay for them to struggle. They've got to come to that conclusion. So if you plant the seed through sharing your experience and they start looking at their life, great. Let them struggle with it. They've got to reach their conclusion.
Your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all of the program. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people. Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he does, but you doubt whether you would have made much progress had you not taken action.
So remember back in the chapter, there is a solution, I think, or more about alcoholism, where it says that almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride that the process requires for its successful consummation. Nobody comes in kicking their heels together and saying, whoopee, I'm an alcoholic, I get to work the 12 steps. We just don't do it. It's okay if the newcomer looks at you and says, I don't want to do all that.
On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he shows interest, lend him your copy of this book. If he's not interested in your solutions, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. Skipping over to 96 in the middle. Suppose now you are making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you are available if he wishes to make a decision and tell his story. Skipping over to 97 at the bottom. Though an alcoholic does not respond, there is no reason why you should neglect his family. He should continue to be friendly to them. The family should be offered your way of life. Should they accept and practice spiritual principles, there is a much better chance that the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the order sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. Skipping down another paragraph. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he will get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house.
So if you're doing 12-step work with somebody and they start talking about how if they only had $20, you know, then everything would be okay, or that they need to take care of this or they need to take care of that, let them know that they may need to take care of these things, but that if they focus on getting sober right now, that a lot of these situations will straighten out. Help them with hope. A lot of us just don't have any hope when we get here. We don't believe that any of these situations will straighten themselves out. If the person works on getting sober, all of these situations will take care of themselves just like they did for you. It may not take care of itself the way they want it to, but it'll take care of itself. Be careful about who you're giving money to around AA and who you're helping financially, who you're letting stay in your house and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes it may seem like a genuine great idea, you know, and you'll feel like you're really trying to help somebody, but when you come home and your TV and your stereo are gone, you'll get a resentment, right? What the book tells us, as we just read, is that often we go to extremes to help each other, you know, and to provide certain things with each other, you know, to help each other stay sober and get sober. You've got to judge each situation individually. I can't judge a situation without knowing all the particulars, and your sponsor may have some insight into why they're giving you that guidance in those situations. I've always been told if you loan money to somebody in AA, consider it a gift because you may not be getting it back. You know, and I've got a friend who under the idea of doing 12-step work with somebody that they were sponsoring, let him come stay at his house and came home from work and everything, the furniture, the carpet, the whole deal was gone. Right? Listen, drunks are drunks, and they're going to do what drunks do. So you got to be willing to accept those consequences if you're going to invite somebody into your house. That's a part of it. Talk about it. Have a conversation with God. Talk to your sponsor. The right answer will come. In these questions, we use the exact same guiding principles as we do in the ninth step and in the other questions we have in AA. Prayer and meditation, counsel with others, the right answers will come.
Skipping over to the bottom of page 99. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We have seen others slip when the family came back too soon. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I'm skipping down to the bottom of the page. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind.
What does that mean? An alcoholic who can't meet these conditions still has an alcoholic mind. An alcoholic who can't meet the regular conditions of the world still has an alcoholic mind. We're still obsessed with somehow, some way being able to control our drinking. We have not had the psychic change. That paragraph we've read over and over on page 84 and 85 has not come true for us. Something's the matter with our spiritual condition.
Mine says there's something the matter with his spiritual status.
That's just a coincidence.
His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap. And even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties. To a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. You will note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places?
So, they're telling us that for an alcoholic, if we still have an alcoholic mind, we can't go somewhere where there's liquor because we'll end up drinking. So if you're not spiritually fit, if you haven't had the experience of working the 12 steps yet, don't go to a place where they're serving liquor because you still got an alcoholic mind. You're going to end up drinking again. They're also telling us that we want to look at our reasons for going to these places. First of all, we have to make sure that we're spiritually fit. If we're not spiritually fit, we can't go. There's no reason for us to be there if we're not spiritually fit. We're tempting providence. They're also saying, do we have a legitimate reason for being there? Which means, if I had a bad day at work, and I'm going to hang out with my friends and shoot pool at a bar so I'll get cheered up and feel better, that's not a legitimate reason. That's what it means when we say, are we hoping to steal some vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere? If you're going someplace to do something so it'll make you feel better, it's dangerous. Instead, what we should do is put the 10th and 11th step to practice in our lives, look to see what aspect of self is out of whack, have a conversation with somebody, pray about it, and look to see where we can be of service to others. That'll put us back into fit spiritual condition.
If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. Be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start, and that your motive is going, and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. But if you are shaky, you had better work with another alcoholic instead. Skipping down a paragraph. Your job is now to be at a place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed.
So, once again, this book was written in 1939. When Bill wrote that statement, what he was saying was, you can go anywhere to do 12-step work. Don't be afraid to reach out to somebody. Don't be afraid about going to the wrong part of town, this, that, and the other. But they didn't have crack cocaine in 1939. So if you get a call from somebody who wants you to come down to the dope house to help them, tell them to meet you at the AA club. Because if I was out smoking dope and I called somebody to come help me, what I would be saying to them is, come down here so I can rob you and keep on smoking dope. So you got to be real careful with these situations. The second suggestion, you're laughing because that's what you did, right? The second suggestion that works really well with these situations is never go on a 12-step call alone. Always bring another person with you, another alcoholic with you. There's two reasons for that. The first is, you may not have the answer that guy needs. It may be that between the two of you, you'll say the right thing. I was at dinner with an old friend the other night who's just trying to get sober again, and it was the regular night that I get together with a friend of mine in the program, so we met, and I brought the newcomer along with me, and it turned out that my friend Ted had all the information that this person needed. He just spoke, and they just sat there and looked at him and said, that's it, that's me, that's it. And no matter what I said, it was wrong. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, this is my friend. This is my 12-step call. That was what God had in mind for me at that moment. That's the way I believe these things work. Take on whatever you want to take on with that, all right? But for me, I bring somebody else with me on a 12-step call because it may be that they've got what that person needs to hear in the moment. The second reason is for safety's sake. Because left with another alcoholic who's drinking, they may get me drinking quicker than I'll get them sober. But if I bring another sober alcoholic with me, they got to get two of us drinking. And that's a lot more work. Never go somewhere where it could be physically dangerous for you on a 12-step call. Tell that person to meet you someplace. If somebody calls for help and they're like, well, this is the address, and you pull up in front of the house, and it's in the middle of the worst neighborhood in town, and there's six guys with guns standing at the door, going inside would be a bad idea. Tell them to come meet you on the corner by the payphone or at a coffee shop or somewhere in public where you can have the conversation with them. Right? If they say to you, I can't leave, I can't get out, then you say to them, there's nothing I can do for you. Call 911. The cops will go get them out and get them to detox. Use common sense, and if you don't have common sense, use your sponsor's common sense. It works just as well. Don't see the person when they're drunk. They're not going to hear anything you have to say, right? See them at the end of a binge, when they're really shaky and they feel awful. That's the best time to do a 12-step call, because that's when they're feeling the worst about what's going on, and physically, you know, they're really suffering, and they're going to be much more eager to try some spiritual solution when they're suffering than they are when everything's well and wonderful. And yeah, you can't argue with a drunk. It's not going to do any good for you. We've covered a lot of information about working the 12-step here. The bottom of page 103 says, someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem. But we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness and hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. What that reminds us of is we've got to practice tolerance and love, especially around doing 12-step work. We've got to do that around the AA rooms where we go. Can't sit around arguing with each other. It's not going to do us any good. Put the principles into application in your life and let the other people do it for themselves. When you're carrying the message to an alcoholic, somebody who's trying to get sober, if they have a different opinion or perspective of you or than you do, instead of arguing about it, say to them, you know, I understand that you think that way. You're welcome to have whatever belief system you want. This is what I found that works for me. And if you'd like to try that, you're welcome to it. But if not, that's okay too. Any questions about doing 12-step work, the 10th or the 11th step? The question was, is if you drink, does that mean you really worked step one, or you didn't really work step one? Step one says that I'm powerless over alcohol. I can know that I'm powerless over alcohol all day long, not have the spiritual solution which provides me with the psychic change, and drink all I want. I can work step one perfectly and get drunk. I'm powerless over alcohol, I can't take a drink today. But if the obsession returns, if I want a drink, and I have no defense against the first drink because I don't have a relationship with a power greater than myself, I'm going to get drunk. Anything else? How do you keep yourself in perspective after going through the steps and you think you've arrived? I call my sponsor. He tells me I haven't arrived. He lets me know exactly where I'm at. He's like, you're still at the bus station waiting. You haven't arrived anywhere yet. It's always good to develop close relationships with other people in AA. And those close relationships will always keep you on the straight and narrow. They'll always help remind you where you're being honest or not honest with yourself, and help keep you in line with what the right action to take in most situations is. Question. The lady brought up other people in her family may have a problem with alcoholism as well, and that she's doing these things and changing, and people see that, but that she can look at people like her son and know that this guy's not going to change if he doesn't do something about his problem. What AA teaches us is that everybody's recovery is between them and their relationship with a power greater than themselves. And what I can do is I can carry the message. Al-Anon's another way. Casey brings up a great point. Al-Anon's probably the greatest tool, not probably, Al-Anon is the greatest tool that's ever come up for family members of alcoholics. It's up to them to do that, but they'll see it working in your life, and then they'll decide for themselves whether that's something they want to embark on. For me, AA meetings are the greatest opportunity I have to be of service and to find people to do 12-step work with. Every time I go to an AA meeting, I can use that meeting in one of two ways. One, I can get something out of it for myself, and two, I can share something of myself with somebody else there and be of service. Both of those ways are great. And I do both of those things at meetings. For me, AA meetings are the greatest opportunity I have to find newcomers to do 12-step work with. You know, the greatest thing about newcomers at an AA meeting is they know less than you. You don't even have to worry about looking bad when you're doing 12-step work with them. You can just spout off some stuff about how you stopped drinking and now you're working on getting a relationship with a power greater than yourself, and they'll be like, wow, that's great. Would you be my sponsor? It's a great opportunity to put the 12-step program into application in my life, going to AA meetings and finding people to be of service for. Like, you know, we've said this a couple of times over the weekend. The only thing you need to do 12-step work with is to have an understanding of what AA says it means to be an alcoholic and to not have liquor on your breath. If you've got those two things, you're going to relate to that other person. You know, we've got this alcoholism. This disease gives us a common bond that other people don't enjoy in the world. It levels all the playing fields. Chances are, right now, there's people that make $1 million a year in this room, and there's people like me that make $20 a year, just in case there's an IRS agent here. Right? Just joking. Seriously, we cross all socioeconomic lines, all religious bodies. What happens is I'm an alcoholic, and when I start talking about alcoholism with another alcoholic, whether they're sober or not, they hear what I'm saying loud and clear. It comes across in a way that nobody else can to them. That's the tool that we have. Sometimes when you go to AA meetings, she says, you hear people complain and talk about their problems. Has anybody ever experienced that at an AA meeting? anybody ever go to an AA meeting where somebody complained or talked about a problem? That's a part of AA meetings. That's a part of AA meetings. What I get to do is, in that moment with that person who's struggling, is be of service to them. And then the meeting's a great opportunity for me to practice the principles of the program. Listen, you ain't never going to get people to stop complaining at an AA meeting. It's just not going to happen. Alcoholics love to complain. It's probably, being a doctor at a treatment center is probably the most miserable experience you can have. Because you're going to hear everything from boils on your butt to broomsticks in the brain. You know, alcoholics love to complain. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that spend a lot of time in AA and don't work the 12 steps. That's why we're making this CD. Hopefully, you may be listening right now. Somebody out there is going to get this CD and listen to it and say, wow, I can work the 12 steps. I didn't know I could. I didn't know that it was that simple. Joe and Charlie, these two guys that do this big book workshop, one of them since passed on, but the other is still doing it with somebody else right now. Joe and Charlie have done the big book workshop, the Joe and Charlie big book workshop, for years, for decades. And hopefully I'm not stealing anything by saying what they said. They were asked once, what would happen? Why would AA fail? How could AA ever fail? And what they said was that AA will fail if the old-timers stop saying what AA is. But it doesn't just mean people, old-timers with a lot of sobriety. It means that if alcoholics who have the message don't carry it to other alcoholics, then AA could fail. But as long as we take the time to learn how to work the 12 steps and put them into application in our lives, and then we share that with other people, AA is going to live just fine. It's going to be just fine. You know, we started off this weekend with 50 people in the room. So there's 50 people here now that have the solution, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we've gone through it and we understand it thoroughly. You get to choose whether you want to carry that to somebody else or not. My hope, the reason why I do this, is that you will do that. You know, I get to stay sober out of doing this. It's great for me. There's no expectation I have of anybody doing anything. But part of the reason why I'm doing it is because I hope that in carrying this message to somebody else, that they'll carry it to somebody else also. We meet regularly so that the newcomer can find the fellowship that he craves. But each AA group is autonomous. An AA group gets to say, do, or be whatever it wants to be, and there's no punishment if it screws it up. Famous part from one of our traditions, I think it's the fourth or sixth tradition, Rule 62, right? Don't take yourself so seriously. It's really important for me to remember that I'm not in charge of the AA meetings that I go to. It's not my job to determine what people should or shouldn't be saying or doing there. The first tradition tells me that no alcoholic can make another alcoholic do anything ever. It says none of us can tell another alcoholic what to say, think, or do. We just can't do it. So if people are coming to meetings and they're complaining about their situation and they're doing it for 7 years, that's just what they're doing and that's what they need to be struggling with. And I can try and share my experience and what works for me in the way that I've done that here with you guys today. But if they're not going to hear it, they're not going to hear it. It's not my job to remind them of it on a daily basis. Like every time this guy starts talking about his situation, you know, I'm going to groan, you know, in the meeting out loud and say, just work the steps already. That's not my job. When I lived in Israel, the group in Jerusalem was very small, and there was only one. So all the drunks in Jerusalem had to go to the same place. So there was these two guys, both of them were named Dave. Both of them were crazy as could be, literally crazy as could be. One Dave thought his father was like from the mafia and a general in the army, and the other Dave, I don't even know what was going on with him, but he was still traveling with Jerry, the Grateful Dead. So whenever one of the crazy Daves would start to share, the other crazy Dave would groan. Literally, the guy would start talking, he would go, the guy would keep talking, he would go, and then every couple of weeks they would get in a fist fight in the hallway or the foyer going into the meeting. It didn't work. No matter what they did, they were never going to change the other person and what they were doing. Now the quandary, of course, that the group had is that it couldn't kick either of them out because it was the only show in town. There was no other AA meeting that these guys could go to stay sober. So as long as they had a desire to stop drinking and they weren't hurting anybody seriously, the group had to keep letting them come back. But neither of them were doing either of them any good by complaining about what they were doing. Just not our job to monitor and control what other people are doing in meetings.
Well, the question was, how do I manipulate
in the prison? So my suggestion is to contact the AA central office in the area that you live, and they'll have a committee on hospital and institutional meetings and work directly with them on carrying the AA message into that prison. And there's a pamphlet that AA produces called The AA Message in Hospitals and Institutions, or AA Behind Bars is another one I think that it's called. There's a couple of different pamphlets out there that you can get that are going to be filled with suggestions on how to do that. The suggestion I would also give is stay away from the word manipulation. Okay? I know that just slipped out, right? After you do the fourth step, it won't slip out as much. Any other questions? So the question is what's the story behind people getting stuck on steps, and if you stay on a step for a long period of time? I've got no opinion on that. I know exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous tells me, and there's no place in the book Alcoholics Anonymous where it says stop here and wait. Every step is followed up by one phrase. What's that phrase? Action and more action. Exactly. So what I know is that if I'm stopped somewhere in the program of recovery, then I'm stopped somewhere in the program of recovery and I'm not working the program as it's meant to be put into application. For me. Anything else? Thank you all for taking the time to be here this weekend. It's been great for me. I hope you guys got something out of it. And I'll look forward to seeing all of you as we trudge the road to happy destiny.